Okay, now we have to get serious after that. Lord, don't let my brother get killed and help those dirty communists too. That's not the right way to get serious, I guess. Those were the first words prayed by a boy 9 years old by the name of Jack. And if you knew his story, you would understand where some of that comes from. Jack, his father was dead. He lived with his mother above a bar where she worked as a waitress. He had two brothers, one in jail, and the other one was a soldier in Korea. He'd never been to church. He'd never been to Sunday school. And yet somehow he found himself at this midweek church activity with some buddies from school. And when it came time to pray, the leader just said to them, you know, just tell God what you're thinking. Just talk to him. Just tell him how you feel and what it is that you want. And so Jack did just that. And his prayer is amazing. Obviously not because he prayed for his brother's protection, because, I mean, we've all prayed for something similar to that. In fact, there's probably somebody we're praying for in our lives right now that we're praying for their protection, but because he prayed for the enemy, an enemy that could very likely take away the person that it appears he thought most highly of. And no doubt Jack prayed well beyond his ability to understand what he was saying, but there's something about his prayer, I think, that should at least cause us to examine our own prayers sometimes that tend to be a little self-serving. It puts a finger on a very important question that many of us, if we think much about it at all, we might assume we already know the answer to. One way to ask that question would be, where does God fit into our plans? And from a certain perspective, to put it simply, he doesn't, typically. Or to ask the question another way, is God on our side? And my answer to that question might surprise you. God is not on our side. I know, to say it just like that's shocking. I get that. And what I want to do this morning is just spend a few minutes unpacking what I mean by that. And I want to do it by taking a look at a story from a famous Old Testament figure by the name of Joshua. If you're not familiar with Joshua, you might recognize the name of his predecessor, Moses. Joshua took over after the death of Moses to finish up the work that Moses had started in leading the people to the promised land. We spent almost an entire summer in the book of Joshua a couple of years ago. But as we catch up with Joshua, he's very early on in his role as the new leader of Israel in chapter 5. And he finds himself between a rock and a hard place. And we pick up the story in Joshua chapter 5, beginning at verse 13. It says, when Joshua was near the town of Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a sword in hand. Joshua went up to him and demanded, "Are you friend or foe?" "Neither one," he replied. "I am the commander of the Lord's army." Well, if you know anything about the story of Israel and the story of Joshua, about what has happened up to this point, you can see what's happening here. Joshua, as I said, he finds himself between a rock and a hard place. Just before this event, God has miraculously brought them across the flooded Jordan River. So he's got the flooded Jordan behind him, which pretty much gets rid of any question for him and the people to retreat. And standing right in front of him is the city of Jericho, with its huge walls and guards on the walls, which really kind of takes away any question of whether or not they can advance. And in between these two obstacles is this plain, this valley that the people of Israel find themselves in, basically like sitting ducks. Now, up to this point in their lives and in their existence, God's reputation had saved the people of Israel. His incredible displays of power had led them to where they were at this point. and had at least also up to this point convinced any of the enemies, any of the kings and leaders that they might encounter along the way, had convinced them to not attack. And it was a good thing, because if you knew anything about the people that Joshua had under his command, I mean, these were not Green Berets. They weren't even privates in the this was a ragtag bunch of people with very few weapons and really limited fighting experience. Most of their experience was running. And so you can understand why Joshua took a walk. I mean, we've all found ourselves at some place like that where we just, you got to get away. You got to get your thoughts all together. You got to figure out what's going on. You got to clear your head. And for Joshua, he knew that war or some kind of conflict was probably just a few days away. And the future of an entire nation was at stake and in his hands, and he did not have any idea what he was going to do. Inevitably, he's kind of drawn toward this obstacle, toward Jericho, which is the biggest obstacle he's faced in his young career. And it's here, almost in the shadow of the great walls of this city, that Joshua has the most important experience in his life. He meets a man with a drawn sword. Now, there are a lot of biblical scholars that believe that the man that he encounters was at least some form of God appearing in flesh. Some people believe that it was Christ. They would call him the pre-incarnate Christ, that it's Jesus showing up in the Old Testament. Whoever it was that shows up, he gets Joshua's attention. And Joshua asks him, "Are you friend or foe?" Another translation says, "Are you for us or for our enemies?" It was a natural question. It was a human question. It was a question of self-defense. Because if the guy says, "I'm a foe," Joshua's probably going to have to defend himself. The fight is going to be on. So he's preparing himself for what might happen next. But most likely, as tends to happen in Scripture in some of these stories, there's a little bit deeper issue going on here. There's a question here, as I said earlier, that we often assume that we already know the answer to. Is God on our side? I mean, what kind of question is that? Of course God's on our side. This is America. We live in Fulton County. Of course God's on our side. And that assumption tends to be reinforced depending on the environment that you grow up in. If you grow up in an environment that continually reinforces that assumption, it's easy to make that. But my question is, can we really make that assumption? Can we really just automatically know that, well, yes, God is absolutely on our side? More importantly, is that assumption consistent with what we see in Scripture? Is it consistent with what we see in this story? Well, perhaps the answer that Joshua gets to his question can help us find an answer to our own. "Whose side are you on?" Joshua asks. "Neither one. I am the commander of the Lord's army," was the reply. Now, to this point in history, there had been no nation, maybe even, I would say probably even since, there had been no nation in history that had had the right to expect that God was on their side than the people of Israel. And there had been no individual who had more reason to believe that God was on his side in this moment than Joshua. I mean, just think about all of the things that they have experienced up to this point. And yet, God makes it pretty clear through this man that Joshua encounters that even though he had brought these people out of bondage in Egypt, even though he had miraculously led them across a couple of water crossings by this point, and he had protected them, and even though he had called Joshua to lead them, he was not by default here on their behalf. When the man answers neither one, God was communicating a powerful truth to Joshua and by extension to us, and that's that God doesn't choose sides. Now that statement I know is shocking to some of us, and it sounds odd, and there may be some of you who are disagreeing vehemently with that. You don't look like you are, but you might be holding it in. I don't know. And I get that. And if I were to just leave it at that, I would be communicating a half-truth to you. Because there's more to the story than just those two statements that I've made so far. And we can see that from the next couple of things that we see happen in Joshua's story. We pick it back up in the second half of verse 14. At this, at the reply of the man, Joshua fell with his face to the ground in reverence. "I am at your command," Joshua said. "What do you want your servant to do?" The commander of the Lord's army replied, "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy." And Joshua did as he was told. Now into chapter 6. Now the gates of Jericho were tightly shut because the people were afraid of the Israelites. No one was allowed to go out or in. But the Lord said to Joshua, "I have given you Jericho, its king, and all its strong warriors." So we see Joshua's response to this reply from the man with the drawn sword as he falls on his face in reverence and he asks what he, the servant, should do. What is it that I'm supposed to do? And the man calls Joshua to take off his sandals. Why? Well, because the place that he was standing was holy. That really doesn't probably make a whole lot of sense to us. But in that simple act, it's an acknowledgement that, you know, had Joshua left his sandals on, it would have been very easy for him to turn tail and run. He takes his sandals off. He's submitting kind of trust and worship to God in this moment. He knows that he's in the very presence of God. Now, let's unpack that a little bit and just to see what the significance of all of this is. We move immediately from that scene where Joshua responds this way and the people facing the very obstacle to Joshua and the people facing the very obstacle that had been causing him so much anxiety. Jericho. Jericho was the next major obstacle standing in the way of the people of God in the promised land. And the timing, there was a very subtle statement there in the opening verses of chapter 6. The timing could not have been better for an attack. If you had read earlier in Joshua, as well as a statement that's made here at the beginning, when the Amorite kings and the Canaanite kings and basically all of the rulers of that area had heard how God had miraculously and powerfully rescued the people of Israel, it says they lost heart and were paralyzed with fear because of them. You see, the reason that Jericho was shut up was because the people were scared to death of the Israelites. They wouldn't let anybody out, wouldn't let anybody in. So the people of God really have their enemies right where they want them. They're emotionally exhausted. They're scared. It was, by all outward appearances, the perfect time to attack. And yet God didn't give the charge call that time, at that moment. He didn't give them the victory immediately. Before he would allow them to advance and take the city, he had to know one very specific thing. Are you committed to me? Do I have your hearts? In the first half of chapter 5, we find that they're at a point in the history of Israel where everybody that had been led out of Egypt and had crossed the Red Sea was dead. That entire generation was gone. It was the next generation, the new generation, that was a part of this story. The people who had first pledged their allegiance and devotion to God and whom God had promised to lead to this wonderful promised land, they were no more. This was a brand new generation, and he calls this people, this new generation, to the same commitment that original generation had made. He calls them to a renewal of their commitment to him. Before they could move forward, God had to know that they were all on the same page. And so they go through this ceremony to reestablish the covenant and reaffirm their commitment to God. And as a result, afterwards they celebrate the Passover, which was a commemoration of how God had rescued them. And so they celebrate to seal the renewal of the commitment. Now, all of this is going on in the immediate background of where Joshua is now. He's just come out of this celebration. He's just come out of this renewal and the nation's recognition of God's rightful place and their commitment to putting all of their own hopes and dreams and wishes secondary to God's will. But God wasn't done with Joshua. He needed a more personal, and you got to remember, Joshua is the leader of these people. God doesn't just need to know that the people have chosen to obey and renew their commitment. He needs it from Joshua. And Joshua, in turn, probably needed a little bit more personal assurance from God that he still had his back, that all of this was going to come off. Enter the man with the drawn sword. Take off your sandals, for the place where you're standing is holy. Now, if you know anything about Old Testament history, that's not the first time a sentence like that was said. His predecessor Moses heard very similar words when he stood before the burning bush. Take off your sandals, for the place you were standing. Joshua is finding himself in almost the exact same spot, a little bit different situation, that Moses found himself in all those years before. And he had to make a choice. Am I going to go with God and follow Him, or am I going to choose my own way? Am I going to obey? Which brings us to the other side in the rest of the story, the other side of this coin. God doesn't choose sides, but He does call us to choose sides. And as I said, in what seems like a strange scene to us, the man tells Joshua to take off your sandals, because you're standing on holy ground. Show by the simple act that you are committed to God, that you will move in obedience to Him. And you notice it's turned here because God is the one asking the questions now. Whose side are you on, Joshua? And Joshua answers. He takes off his sandals and he shows which side he has chosen. Now, as we move into chapter 6, God gives Joshua some good news. These questions that have been lingering in Joshua's head as he's staring at Jericho. God says to him, I have given you Jericho, its king, and all its warriors. And basically, he says, son, city's yours. There's not really a whole lot of question about the outcome of that. God tells Joshua, you know what? It's yours. And I'm sure the significance of the timing of this immediately following Joshua's encounter with the man with the sword isn't lost on him. Because he and the people have learned a couple of very important lessons. One, that it's not, the question isn't necessarily whether or not God is on our side, it's whether we have chosen to be on His side. And second, we can't just assume that God is going to choose to back us. And they're about to learn a very important lesson on top of all this, and that's that only as they choose to be on God's side will they be victorious. The same thing applies to us. Only as we choose to be on God's side will we be victorious. Unfortunately, the course of history, not just for the rest of the Old Testament, but really the history as we know it, is that's a lesson that has been hard for us to learn. It was a lesson that was hard for the people of Israel to learn, that only as they were on God's side would they experience victory. But there's even more to the story than that, because if I were to just tell you that if you choose to be on God's side, everything will all go well and everything will all fall into place, that would be another half-truth that I would be telling you. Yes, God promised victory to Joshua and the people, but the way that it came about was, well, weird. It was odd. And there have been all sorts of radical battle plans in the history of warfare and that have changed the course of history. But I don't know that any have been as strange and as radical as the instructions that God gives the people concerning Jericho. Chapter 6, verse 3 says, "You and your fighting men should march around the town once a day for 6 days. 7 priests will walk ahead of the ark, each carrying a ram's horn. On the 7th day, you are to march around the town 7 times with the priests blowing the horns. When you hear the priests give one long blast on the ram's horns, have all the people shout as loud as they can. Then the walls of the town will collapse and the people can charge straight into the town." We've got a military guy, right? That doesn't sound like a good battle plan. So let me get this straight. Once around the town for 6 days. The 7th day, 7 times, blow the horn, shout, walls fall, we get city. Yeah, okay. I think we need a new general. Now, fortunately, we know the rest of the story because we know that it actually worked. Verses 20 and 21 tell us that when the horns blew and the people shouted, the walls fell. They went in, captured the city, and destroyed everything in their wake. Almost everything, but that's another story for another time. And what's almost more amazing than the fact that this worked was the fact that, you know, there was no point in those 7 days where somebody, and this is, I love this description, somebody who knew too much to follow and not enough to lead couldn't have just ruined the whole thing. All it took was one guy to charge the walls because they didn't agree with the plan. The author of the book, The Robe, which is a classic piece of Christian literature, Lloyd Douglas, he preached a sermon once on the collapse of Jericho. And this is, I love this description. He says, "All that was necessary to wreck the movement was for some impertinent little man to pull out an impudent little leather slingshot from his silly little belt, whirl it around his empty little head, and fire an impotent little pebble toward his revilers on the wall. The program was constantly at the mercy of any crank, any boaster, any egoist, any bumptious yokel with a pigeon brain and big biceps. But strangely, they all kept their heads. They held their tongues, they obeyed orders, minded their own business, and Jericho fell." There's another important truth here that we need to learn, or for some of us, we need to be reminded of. Sometimes choosing God's side makes no sense. It makes no sense. If Israel had a military expert and Joshua had run these battle plans by him, there would have been a coup. Now think about this. The actual act of physically walking around Jericho, wasn't the tough part. Jericho was a city of about 8 or 9 acres inside the walls. And if you stayed even far enough away that you weren't within shot of the archers that were guarding the city, you could still walk around the city in about a half hour if you kept at a comfortable pace. But to do something that makes absolutely no sense, that doesn't look like it has any chance of success, that everybody watching you can just imagine what the people of Jericho were thinking as they just saw these weirdos marching around their city. Probably boosted Jericho's confidence. To do something that, and not defend yourself, and to do it multiple days. We have a hard time doing things that don't make sense for a couple of hours. 6 days, and then the seventh day, you do it 7 times as much as you did at the other 6. That takes something else. It takes a great faith in a great God. It is short-sighted. And those of us who have journeyed with God for any length of time, this is more for us. It's short-sighted for us to think that just because we choose to be on God's side, everything is going to be hunky-dory. That we aren't going to run into obstacles, that He's not going to call us to do things that just seem weird. And it's even more short-sighted to limit our obedience to Him to the moments that make sense to us. When we choose to follow God, we are choosing to follow someone who is far wiser and powerful and just than we can even begin to comprehend. But we are also choosing to follow someone who is far more loving and gracious and generous than we can even begin to comprehend. And we're also following someone who will grant everything that we need to make it through those moments that just don't make any sense. What can we expect if we choose to be on God's side? Well, we can't necessarily expect everything to just go as we want it to go. But I think we can expect the same strength that God granted Joshua and the people to do what they did. It's the kind of strength that God grants to those who don't limit Him to fighting on their side. It's very subtle. But who choose to humble themselves before Him and choose to follow Him, choose to be on His side. There's victory for everyone who chooses to follow the commander of the Lord's army and obey His commands, even when we don't fully understand the meaning of it all, even when we can't see the result. God doesn't choose sides, but He does expect us to, even when it doesn't make sense. You bow your heads with me. I don't know what brought many of you here today. Most of you who are probably here, you're either a part of this church, you were invited by somebody. Some of you, it makes no sense why you're here today. And you may find yourself in a place that you're wondering, what next? And the question that we all have to face is God on my side, but have I taken the step? Have I made the choice to be on His side? Like I said, if there was ever an individual in the history of mankind up to that point who had the right to assume that God was on his side, it was Joshua. And yet in that response from the man, we see that the question is not whether or not God is on our side. Whose side are you on? And I would love to tell you that if you make the choice to be on God's side, that everything will just, a light bulb will go off and everything will come into place and everything will make sense. That's not always how it happens. Even this first step of choosing to be on God's side might not make any sense to you. It might not feel like something that you can do, but you're choosing to follow one who will give you everything that you need to make that choice. To step out, to follow Him, to choose to be on His side. The whole point is that we can't do it. Joshua knew he couldn't defeat Jericho. And so God had to reassure him that, that's okay, I'm going to take care of this. I've delivered Jericho into your hands. God supplies, God empowers, God's the one that equips. We say yes. If you find yourself in a place this morning like Joshua, where maybe you've been asking that question, is God on my side? Maybe you're asking the wrong question. The question is, have you chosen to be on God's side? And if this man that Joshua encountered was Jesus before he set foot on the earth in the New Testament, it's so fitting that he's the one really who opens the door and gives the access. Because that's just what we experience. We have access to God because of what Jesus has done. Because Jesus is sitting at his Father's right hand holding the door open. That's how we have access. And so if you find yourself this morning at that kind of crossroads, at that decision, you can just pray this prayer with me. You pray quietly, pray it out loud. Lord Jesus, I spent all this time wondering if you've been on my side. But maybe the question is, have I chosen to be on your side? I want to take the step that you've made available to me to choose to be on God's side. And in those moments where even this step, maybe the next ones you call me to take, don't make sense, may I trust you just as Joshua and the people did, knowing that I may not have all of the answers of how all of this is going to work, but I can trust that it's only as I choose to follow you and choose to be on your side that I can experience hope and joy and victory in my life. And so I take this step this morning to choose to follow you.